I'm sure you've heard the story of the monk who joined a monastery and he took a vow of silence. And after 10 years of silence, his superior called him in and said to this monk, "I give you permission to speak. Do you have anything to say?" And the monk replied, "Bad food. Bad food." Well, another whole 10 years go by, and again he had the opportunity to voice his thoughts, and he said, "Bed hard, bed hard." Well, then after another 10 years of silence, again he was called in before his superior, and when asked if he had anything to say, the monk replied, "I quit, I quit." And the superior answered, "It doesn't surprise me. You've done nothing but complain ever since you got here." 30 years. In our travels with the man Moses, it probably wouldn't surprise us if he quit. Moses was God's servant to deliver his people, the Israelites, out of bondage in Egypt into the land of promise that God had said he would give to their forefathers and he would give to them. And it seems like that from the time the Israelites left Egypt, all they have done is complain. And they had a lot more to say than that monk. One of their complaints was bad food, or more accurately, the complaint was the monotony of food delivered to them by the hand of God, as we're going to see in a moment. Well, this morning, I want to jump ahead a bit to a time on the other side of receiving the law of God at Mount Sinai. We'll come back to that in a future passage, a future week, as well as another passage that precedes this situation. But today, I want to fast forward to a passage in the book of Numbers in order to continue on the subject of last week. I figured speaking on the matter of complaining and grumbling just wasn't convicting enough for 1 week. Let's do this again. How you doing, by the way, with your complaint jar? Yeah, it's been the source of many conversations in our home. We've found that we've kind of redefined complaint. No. That was just a statement. No. It was a complaint, right? Well, in case you weren't with us last week, I issued a challenge that I borrowed from someone else to get a jar or container and put the words complaint jar on it. And any time you complain, you put money into that jar. Maybe it's a dollar, maybe 50 cents. And you do that for at least 2 weeks. I would say, let's do it for a month. And then whatever you do with the money is up to you. You can give it to one of your favorite pastors. I don't care. But you whatever, right? That doesn't matter. The point is that tangibly we see how our complaining cost us. For the truth is, complaining does cost us. It tests the Lord. It poisons our spirit. And complaining negatively affects those around us. And that's really my approach for this morning, to consider the other side of the coin, the effect complaining has on others, particularly Moses. It's in our study this morning that we see just how destructive a bad attitude can be. All right, turn your Bibles to the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers, chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. Numbers is the fourth book of the Bible. And by the time we get to this point in the book of Numbers, God has entered into covenant with the Israelites. He provided good law to them on how they could live in harmony with God, how they could live with harmony with each other. And he gave them a tabernacle and a priesthood, and he formed them into well-organized troops or camps. Numbers picks up the narrative 1 year and 1 month after God had brought them out of the land of Egypt. Now, there was a cycle I mentioned last week that it's worth repeating this morning, a cycle that the Israelites found themselves in on this journey, but it's one that's true for us here in Laconia in 2019. Here's the cycle. Blessing of God. God blesses. And then we expect that he continue in that blessing. And when he doesn't, then we're disappointed. And when we're disappointed, then we complain. God in his mercy blesses us. And then we expect him, well, you got to keep doing it, God. He doesn't. We get disappointed and we complain. And around it goes. That's a cycle. Well, we pick it up in Numbers 11 with the people in a time of blessing. And so if you're in Numbers 11, just go back for a moment to chapter 10, verse 33. Chapter 10, verse 33, probably on the same side of your Bible here. It says, they set out from the mountain of the Lord and traveled for 3 days. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them during those 3 days to find them a place of rest. Now, 3 days is significant. You might recall that it only took the people 3 days to go from the amazing grace of God's deliverance and passing miraculously through the Red Sea to astonishing grumbling. 3 days. Amazing grace, astonishing grumbling. 3 days. Well, once again, the people are coming off of blessing, and they begin their triumphal march to Canaan from Mount Sinai, and it took them only 3 days, once again, to complain. That brings us to Numbers chapter 11. And we're going to look this morning at threats to our spiritual well-being, threats to being used by God. Threat number one is chronic complaining. Chronic complaining. Numbers chapter 11, Moses first faced a people problem. He faced a people problem, chapter 11, verse 1. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord, and we heard them as anger was aroused. And fire from the Lord, which some suggest was similar to a lightning strike, that it burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. When the people cried out to Moses, he prayed to the Lord, and the fire burned down, so that place was called Taberah, because fire from the Lord had burned among them. Now, their complaining, notice, aroused God's anger, and some fire consumed a portion of the edge of the camp. This fire that struck around them was a warning from God that he was displeased with them. And the fact that it strikes the outskirts of the camp is worth noting, because I believe that indicates that the cause of the complaining came from those on the fringes, those who were non-Israelites living among them on the outskirts. We hear more about them in the next verse, verse 4. Verse 4 says in the NIV, the rabble with them. Now, some translations, I'm going to stop here for a minute. Some translations say mixed multitude. Well, this group were the non-Jewish people from the surrounding nations. They are non-Israelites who joined in the Exodus from Egypt. And the NIV translates it, the rabble, which I believe is more accurate. This is the only time that this word rabble is used in Scripture, and it means riffraff or those who are not respectable. I call them rabble rousers. Or troublemakers, because they like to stir things up. And that's exactly what happens here. Verse 4 continues. The rabble, the troublemakers with them, began to crave other food. And again, the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. There's some rumbling from the rabble that rapidly spreads to the rest of the group. It began with a few rabble rousers who threw one stone of discontent in the water, and then watch it ripple to involve the whole Israelite community. I mean, how many times have you seen that happen? I mean, you know what I've noticed? As soon as a group gets large enough, the rabble will show up. Anytime there's some momentum, there will always be some individuals who like to sow seeds of discontent. Listen, church, don't get drawn into the rumblings of the rabble. Rabble-rousers show up all over the place. They show up at Christian schools. They show up in churches. They show up at Christian colleges. They show up at Bible studies. They show up in youth groups. They show up in church plants. They'll show up anywhere else where it is tolerated. Let's call it what it is, chronic complaining. And it aroused the anger of the Lord. And so they plant the seed of discontent. It goes out of control from there. And then now Moses not only has a people problem, he has now a provision problem. Verse 5, remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost, also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic, but now we have lost our appetite, we never see anything but this manna. Well, we've been around this block before. They have spiritual amnesia, again, short-term memories. I find it rather interesting that in that verse that they speak of what they ate in Egypt as being at no cost. Well, the food was free, but what did it cost them? Their freedom? It costs them some crack of the master's whip on their body. The demands to make brick without straw. It costs them the murder of their children at no cost. Isn't it amazing? It is amazing how we glorify the past and make it better than it really was when we tire of our present situation. And isn't that really the issue? What's their complaint? Verse 6. But now we have lost our appetite. Literally, it says our souls are dried or they're withering and can't go on. And they cry out, end of verse 6, we never see anything but this manna. Kind of like the husband who protested at the dinner table. Beans again? To which the wife responded, I don't understand it. You like beans on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and all of a sudden you don't like beans? You're going, no, don't do this right now. You know what I'm saying? We get tired of the same old diet. That's what's going on for them. And when the children came in for dinner, they didn't ask what's for dinner. They asked, how will manna be fixed tonight? You might remember Keith Green, who wrote the song, Want to Go Back to Egypt. And he had a lot of fun with this manna thing. And he said they had manna waffles and manna bagels and filet of manna and manna patty and banana bread. And he goes crazy with it. But listen, God's provision of this manna was no small thing. Further down this passage, in verses 7 through 9, it references God miraculously providing for his people daily manna. You see, manna was a nutritious, tasty, bread-like substance that could be prepared in a variety of ways. I spent a lot of time on it last week. I'm not going to repeat that this morning. But it was hand-delivered by a merciful, gracious God. They never went hungry. They didn't have to work for their food. They didn't have to worry if they'd have enough food for the day. They didn't have to pay for it. God provided them with exactly what they needed each day. What was happening, though? It's here, I believe, that a complaining spirit often begins. You start to get tired of the same old, same old. You get tired of the same old school, the same old car, the same old house, the same old church, the same old toy, the same old friends, the same old spouse, the same old pastor. I mean, you get the point. And you say, I want out. Do you have the same old disease? I'm just kind of tired of this. You think a change on the outside is the answer? Think again. I mean, you're having this midlife crisis kind of thing going on and you're only in your 20s. The fix isn't some change on the outside. What you need is a change in here. The real issue is one of discontentment. It's one of ungratefulness. It's one of never being satisfied. It's the myth of the greener grass. It's inside here. And let me tell you, it will poison your spirit. It will take its toll on all those people around you. Moses found himself in the middle of this grumbling, and he now faced a personal problem. Look at verse 10. It says, Moses heard the people of every family wailing, each at the entrance to his tent. And so Moses is walking by the tents, and all he was hearing were complaints, nothing but manna, nothing but manna, nothing but manna. It was the people were singing all the same song. Now, before you start to sympathize with the people who had it with manna, read the rest of verse 10. It says, the Lord became exceedingly angry. Because, you know, I think all too often we sympathize with those when they're complaining. God is angry with his people here. No, correction. He is exceedingly angry. What effect does all this complaining have on Moses? Well, the last four words of verse 10 stated plainly, and Moses was troubled. Moses was troubled. You see the threat to one's well-being when surrounded by chronic complaining? He was troubled. It's the idea, by the way, it means to be broken to pieces, to be utterly destroyed. Moses has a breakdown. He takes this real personal. He's had it. He can't take it any longer. And all this whining is wearing a good man down. All this grumbling gets to him. And we now see a man who once stood up to Pharaoh. He's a little bit out of sorts, to say the least. We see his humanness. Verse 11. He asks the Lord, at least he knows where to go with his complaint. Why have you brought this trouble on your servant? I love these verses here. I love these questions he asks. What have I done to displease you that you put the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant to the land you promised on oath to their forefathers? Where can I get meat for all these people? Now, I don't know about you, but my heart goes out to Moses here. Because anyone who has served in ministry knows something of what Moses felt, whether pastor or lay leader or volunteer or anyone who's just jumped in and helped. And then to hear someone grumble about it, it can steal your joy. It can turn that service into burden and at times seem unbearable. That's the threat. I mean, it gets so bad for Moses that he lashes out to God and asks him to take his life. Verse 15. He reaches an all-time low. If this is how you're going to treat me, put me to death right now. Wow. Moses losing heart. He's saying, I quit. It's going to be like this, Lord. Why go on? I mean, at least he knows where to go with his troubles. I'm going to give him that. And the Lord steps in and he lifts him up. He meets Moses where he's at. And we can't go into all this morning. He instructs Moses, though, to reach out to 70 other spiritual leaders to help carry this load. It tells us in verses 16 and following. You can read it for yourself. But there is a real lesson here for us, and I want us to grab it. Any servant of God can succumb to discouragement. Any servant of God can succumb to discouragement. Because the threat to our well-being is listening to belly aching. If you listen to complaining long enough, it will get to you. I mean, how many people have left leadership or left teaching God's word or serving in the church because of the constant complaining? And this is why complaining must be addressed, because it won't stop on its own. Left alone, it is a threat to God's servants doing God's work. Constant complaining has the potential to wear others out. And so, let me say this lovingly. If your complaining spirit is doing that to those whom you're serving, who are serving, I plead with you to stop. Because any servant of God can succumb to discouragement. I mean, you might think, someone come to your mind right now who might be losing heart because of discouragement. Maybe drop them a note, send them a text, give them a call. Assist them in carrying the load. Maybe you're here this morning and your passion for the Lord is being threatened and you're about to give up serving as God's instrument. I mean, you've heard the complaining and you have had it. Listen, live above it. Bring it to the Lord. He'll provide you with some timely relief. I mean, it may be a threat, but it doesn't have to end poorly for you. And Moses is trying to bounce back from this, and just as he's bouncing back from one threat, his head's still spinning. He's still trying to make sense of all. He's hit again. I mean, how much can one person take? Well, look with me at Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12. Here's a second threat to his well-being. I call it sibling slander. Chapter 12. Follow along. Verse 1. Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he had married a Cushite. Now notice, they're not talking with Moses or talking to Moses. They're talking against Moses. And it seems to come out of nowhere. I mean, if it's Zipporah that they're referring to, was his wife that he found in Midian, then this is, you know, this is a long time before that. This is finally said. This is years. So we don't really know who this wife is, but my guess is I can assume that Zipporah passed away, and this is Moses' second wife. And if that's the case, then marrying a Cushite was not wrong morally. They just couldn't marry a Canaanite. Nothing said about marrying a Cushite. They just don't like his choice. So they make this false charge. Now the wording here of verse 1 in the Hebrew, it suggests that Miriam is the instigator of this accusation, and Aaron, who's missing a backbone, is easily swayed. He goes along with it. Who's Miriam? Moses' sister. She was the one who preserved her brother's life as an infant, remember? She was the one, and we didn't look at it, but in Exodus 15, she was the one who led the singing of praise after Israel was delivered out of Egypt. Now, this is not one of her finer moments. And she, along with Aaron, Moses' older brother, began a whispering campaign of slandering Moses. And they're saying, we have a problem with Moses' wife. Is that the real issue? I don't think so. The real issue is what we find in verse 2. Has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Hasn't he also spoken through us? What are they saying? They are jealous of Moses and his leadership. They figure they can do as good a job as he. There's jealousy here. That's the issue. Now, do you struggle? Do you struggle with jealousy? Get a handle on it. Get a handle on it, because it is suffocating. Jealousy will decimate a friendship. Jealousy will kill romance. I know. I lived in that place myself of my own jealousy early on in my years with my wife. It's a terrible place to be. It's dark. And so in the previous incident, the people were complaining about their situation. Here is a criticism of the leader. And the difference between a complaint and criticism is that complaining deals with circumstances while criticism deals with people. And if you've ever been criticized, you know it hurts. And when it comes from a family member, it's even more difficult to swallow. When it comes to another brother or sister in Christ, it can be very troubling. But you know what? It doesn't take a lot of skill or talent or even brains to criticize. Anybody can do it. Doesn't take a lot. Likely you've heard the story of a father, a son, and their donkey who were traveling from one village to another. The boy walked while the man rode the donkey. The father overheard a bystander say, "That's a shame. Look how that man is making that poor boy walk." Not wanting to be the object of criticism, the father and son, they changed places. The boy rode the donkey while the man walked. He then heard a woman comment, "Look at how that boy and the donkey is making that poor man walk." So the father and son both climbed onto the donkey. And as they traveled down the road, someone said, "Look how that man and boy are making that poor donkey suffer." So they both got off and walked. The people remarked, "Look at that stupid man and boy. They're walking when they could be riding that donkey." Well, when they entered the next village, the boy was walking and the man was carrying the donkey. Here's the point. The moral of the story, no matter what you do, someone will find fault. No matter what you do, someone will find fault. Because everyone has an opinion on everything. That's why we have restaurant critics and movie critics and political critics and sports critics and church critics. Are you a critic? Well, you might say, yeah, but mine is constructive criticism. Okay, here's a test. Criticism that expresses our negative feelings toward others, that dwell on the perceived faults of others with no view for their good, is destructive. Now, I say perceived faults because often our perception may be wrong. Our perception may not take into account what's going on in a person's life. We just may not have all the information. You see, we're to seek solutions rather than criticism. Now, if you open up your word processing software and you start typing, chances are you're looking at a typeface called Times New Roman. It's so common, we kind of take it for granted, but the super typeface has a very interesting origin. Did you know that it all began with a complaint? In the 1920s, the esteemed type designer Stanley Morrison criticized London's newspaper, The Times, for being out of touch with modern typographical trends. And so The Times replied to Morrison's criticism by asking him to create something better. Well, Morrison took up the challenge. He enlisted the help of expert draftsman Victor Lardent and began conceptualizing a new typeface with two goals in mind, efficiency and readability. But as he went on, he said Morrison wanted any printing in his typeface to be economical, a necessity in the newspaper business. Now, in 1926, The Times tested an early version of Morrison's new type, and after test upon test and proof upon proof, the final design was approved, and the Times New Roman was born. And almost a century later, Times New Roman is still going strong, proving that sometimes there's something better than criticism coming part of the solution. Is there someone you're criticizing right now? How might you be part of the solution? How might that encourage another sibling in the Lord? Well, how did Moses fare this time under this threat? Well, Moses had nothing to lose and nothing to prove, so he remained silent. He didn't even try to defend himself. He could rest assured that he wasn't the only one who heard this accusation. Look at the end of verse 2 of chapter 12, and it says, "And the Lord heard this." And you say, "Oh, of course he did." Well, if we were more mindful of that, that the Lord hears this, and that in every criticism, there's the criticizer, the accused, and between the two is God, it might slow us down a bit. God hears it every time we criticize. He knows the motive behind it that's driving it. He knows when our criticizing of someone else is to make ourselves look better, or because of our own insecurities, or our own fears, or our own cynicism. I may call it all I want, constructive criticism, but he knows what my true intent is. He hears. And when it speaks of God hearing it, by the way, it usually suggests he is about to act. And God does. Verse 4. At once, God doesn't waste any time. At once the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out to the tent of meeting, all three of you." Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds a lot like being called to the principal's office. Not that I know anything of that, of course, but I've heard of people where that's the case. You get this feeling this isn't going to end so well. God then calls Aaron and Miriam to step forward, and God lets us in on what he said to the two of them, beginning with verse 6. "When a prophet of the Lord is among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams. But this is not true of my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house." Do you want God to say that about you? "With him," he says, "I speak face to face," which I believe is a figure of speech, meaning that Moses does not need a mediator. "With him I speak face to face, clearly and not in riddles. He sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" And then we come to verse 9. It sends a shiver up my spine because verse 9 says, "The anger of the Lord burned against them and he left them." God goes to Moses' defense. Being criticized threatens our spiritual well-being. Notice, though, Moses took care of his character and he let God take care of his reputation. Do you find it hard to trust God with your reputation? I sure do. Because it's my pride that says, "How dare you treat me like this? I don't deserve this." Moses lives above this criticism. What does that say about his character? Well, go back now to verse 3. In almost a parenthetical manner, verse 3 says, "Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth." I love this verse. You know why I love this verse? Because Moses wrote this. And you're like, well, doesn't that mean he really isn't? Kind of like the pastor who was awarded with a pin for being a humble pastor, and he wore it to church the next week, so they took it away from him. See, nobody would say this about himself, right? Unless directed by God himself to write it down. But humility, and we only have a few minutes to spend on this, if that, but humility is having a right estimation of ourselves. If I went up to Tom Brady and asked him, "Are you a good quarterback?" Would he answer? No. Or you go up to an Olympian gold medalist and you ask, "Are you a good athlete?" Is it humility to say, "No, not at all"? See, sometimes we try and give people the impression we are more humble than we really are. We go, no, it's not me. I get that. It's from God. I get all that. Sometimes we're trying to give an impression here. Like, see how humble I am? Moses was a humble man. He was a servant leader. But to say it is one thing, but to live in that place of humility is another matter completely. And frankly, whether we're humble or not will be most evident how we respond when criticized. Whether we're humble or not will be most evident in how we respond when criticized. You've heard me say this before. If people are getting to you, it means you're not being humble. Because a part of being humble is developing a thick skin. It's been said this way, maturity is moving from a soft skin and a tough heart to a tough skin and a soft heart. And we see Moses' tough or thick skin, but we see his soft heart. Look at verse 13. This is absolutely remarkable to me. God's punishment, by the way, on Miriam for a critical spirit and harsh words was a skin disease. All right? Now, verse 13, Moses says to the Lord on Miriam's behalf, "Oh God, please heal her." This is the one who sharply criticized him. I ask, would you have prayed like this? Come on, would you pray this? Oh, God, heal her. I mean, in about a week or so, maybe a year. Let her suffer a little bit. Come on, let's be honest. Moses is a humble man. You've been criticized. Can you entrust yourself to him who judges justly? God may not intervene as immediately as he did for Moses, but remain humble. Don't quit. Don't take the matter into your own hands. Don't allow the acid of bitterness to eat away at your life. Keep a tough skin and a soft and tender heart. I know criticism can threaten you. It certainly has me. But it doesn't have to take us down. All right, one last threat. It's found in chapter 14. I call this rash rejection. Numbers 14. You've got to go over to chapter 14. Now, I can't get into all that's here. But this next scene takes us to the edge of Canaan, the promised land. The nation was on the border of their destiny. It was within their reach. They could almost taste it. All they need to do was cross the Jordan into the land of plenty and receive their inheritance from God. It would be militarily advantageous to first send some men into the land to check out the situation so they would know what best strategy to use. Now, you likely know the story. But let me recap it for you for the sake of time. I'd encourage you, though, on your own, read Numbers chapter 13. Read Numbers chapter 13 if you haven't in a while. 12 men go into the land to explore this. They return with mixed reviews. It was, as God said, plentiful. But there are some people that we need to overcome. And you know the story. Two were in favor of going into the land, trust God that he was bigger than these giant-sized men, and 10 of the 12 said, "There ain't no way." Listen, the majority is not always right, by the way. But the majority did get the rest of the community all worked up, and fears take over, and they turn once again on their leader. Follow along with me. Chapter 14, verse 1. It says, "That night all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud." They're weeping because they are fearing for their lives. They're weeping because they listened to the 10 naysayers. Don't believe everything you hear. The Israelites did. And verse 2 says, this is a real shocker. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron. They blame it all on Moses and Aaron. Isn't leadership fun? It gets worse. The whole assembly said to them, Moses and Aaron, "If only we had died in Egypt." We're doing this again. "Or in this desert. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And here's the real zinger right here, verse 4. "And they said to each other, 'We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt.'" And I can hear Moses and Aaron going, "We're standing right here. We can hear you." "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Really? What rejection? It's a ridiculous statement. But when fears run with us, away with us, we lose all reason and common sense. When we start to focus our perspectives on ourselves and our eyes are on our circumstances, we lose all kinds of perspective and we say and do ridiculous things. Listen, rejection stings. Moses knows rejection. Is he going to snap? What do you do with rejection? Well, when God has called you to be his instrument to serve him and you're criticized and rejected, remember this, God calls it rebellion against him. Verse 11, God says to Moses, verse 11, "How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me?" And God then gives Moses a proposition. Very interesting here. In verse 12, in essence, God says, I tell you what, Moses, I will wipe out all these grumblers and I'll start a new nation with you. Come on. Show of hands here. How many would have taken God up on that one? Zap them all. Get rid of them. They deserve it. Show them what happens when you reject a leader. Come on, God, go. It's absolutely amazing. The man in the muddle stands in the middle between the people of God and God. And this humble servant, Moses, says, verse 15, if you put these people to death all at one time, the nations who have heard this report about you will say, the Lord was not able to bring these people into the land he promised them on oath, so he slaughtered them in the desert. You see it, Moses is more concerned about the glory of God than his own comfort. He says, no, Lord, show them you're a God who's slow to anger, verse 17, abounding in love. Forgive these people in their sin and rebellion. Moses was rejected. Moses was ignored, unappreciated, and mistreated. We might even say, if anyone had a right to feel resentment and revenge, it was Moses. You've been shot at? Do you know rejection? Are you fighting resentment towards someone who's pushing you away when you're trying to help? What's threatening your walk with God? What's threatening your being used for Him? And maybe you're here today and you're not serving and you said, I've had it with complaints and criticism, rejection in the church. I will not serve in the church again. Maybe you're here today and you've given up on the church or you're about to give up on the church because of the grumbling and the critical spirit and you can't take it any longer. You may be there today. I almost did years and years ago. When you look at your own heart, though, what do you see? Do you see a critical spirit? Do you see that you're one of the grumblers, that you're a rabble-rouser? You see, attitude is contagious. Is yours worth catching? It's been said, there's only one thing more contagious than a good attitude, a bad attitude. Baseball coach Billy Martin took a hunting trip in Texas with baseball legend Mickey Mantle. Mantle had a friend who would let them hunt on his ranch, and so when he and Billy reached the ranch, Mantle told Billy, you just wait in the car, and I'm going to go and check with my friend, make sure it's okay, we hunt on his land. Well, Mantle's friend quickly gave him permission to hunt, but he asked Mantle a favor. He said, I have an old mule out in the barn who's going blind, and I just don't have the heart to put this mule out of his misery. And so he asked Mickey Mantle to go and shoot the mule for him. Well, Mantle said he would kill the mule for him, and he figured he was going to have a little fun with Billy. So when Mickey Mantle got back in the car where Billy Martin was waiting inside, Mantle came in, he scowled, he slammed the door, he started grumbling and complaining about his friend not letting them hunt on his property. And Mantle said, I'm so mad at that guy, I'm going to go out to his barn and I'm going to shoot one of his mules. Mantle drove like a maniac to the barn and Martin protested, we can't do that. But Mantle was adamant, oh, you just watch me. So when they got to the barn, Mantle jumped out of the car with his rifle. He ran inside, and he shot the mule. Well, as he was leaving, though, he heard two other shots. And he ran back to the car, and he saw Martin had taken out his rifle, too. What are you doing, Martin, he yelled. And Martin yelled back, face red with anger. We'll show that son of a gun. I just killed two of his cows. Attitude is contagious. Is yours worth catching?